Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The foreclosure mess is picking up steam. All those stories of banks faking the paperwork. The Justice Department is looking into fraud. The White House is involved. So today on the broadcast, the paper trail of who did what to whom. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Event Marketing, working to help small businesses and nonprofits make their events easier with event registration and marketing tools. ConstantContact.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today. This one is the 7th of October. Good to have you with us. You don't usually see this happening when the president's party controls Congress, but the White House said today the president is not going to sign a bill that both the House and the Senate have passed. The legislation in question would have required state courts to recognize foreclosure documents that were notarized in other states. That would basically have made it harder to challenge foreclosures when the documents were put together out of state, as is often the case these days. That development, in turn, brings us to a four-letter word you may not have heard of before, even if you might somehow be tied into it. The word is MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System. It was set up to make mortgages easier to track, but has wound up doing quite the opposite, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Back in the day, mortgages were as simple as a piece of paper. They were official, legal documents passed around based on who owned the loan. But back in 1997, the mortgage industry got together and came up with a new idea. Guy Sakala of Inside Mortgage Finance says the idea was,
come up with an electronic registry system for mortgage documents so we could trade mortgages more easily and we wouldn't have any question about who owned the mortgage and all the paperwork associated with it.
That system made trading mortgage investments, as well as slicing and dicing them, as easy as buying and selling stocks. No more going through the county clerk when the loan changed hands. Sakala says today, more than half of the nation's mortgages are registered in the MERS system.
By and large, the system has worked quite well up until now.
But now, since everyone and his brother is going through foreclosure, MERS has become a target for homeowners looking for reasons why their foreclosure notices are invalid. Some state courts have sided with homeowners and ruled that MERS doesn't have the authority to foreclose on a home because, they say, it doesn't officially own the loan. Mortgage industry analyst Thomas LaMalfa of TSL Consulting says if MERS's role is in doubt,
it would create a real problem because it would raise questions about the foreclosure process as well as about foreclosures that have taken place.
That, he says, could drag out foreclosures for months and even years, prolonging the work of stitching the housing market back together.
I would think that there'd be just myriad legal challenges.
And that, analysts say, could have a serious impact on the health of the nation's largest banks, who service many of these mortgages. But Guy Sakala says when it comes to the lawsuits,
we're not talking about foreclosures that shouldn't have been initiated. We're talking about foreclosures that aren't being handled properly.
In other words, with or without MERS, our housing market remains in a whole lot of trouble. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We learned today what some companies are doing with the piles of cash they're sitting on. I'll give you a little hint here. They are not hiring more people. They're buying back their own stock. A new report says almost twice as many companies bought their own shares this year as compared to last year. Hiring? That's just going to have to wait. Janet Babin reports.
This whole hire-don't hire thing is a classic catch-22. Analyst Jeff Rubin with Barini Associates says people aren't buying because they're worried about having a job. And companies won't hire because people aren't buying.
The demand has to come first, and right now you're seeing a tepid pace of that demand. But in order to get demand, I need a job. Well, to get demand, it's back and forth.
Rubin says companies squeezed more productivity out of fewer workers during the recession, so they're happy to put off new hires and instead do things like use their cash to buy back stock. That reduces the number of shares on the market, making them more valuable, and that makes the company more attractive to investors. But there are many theories as to why companies aren't hiring. Harvard economics professor Jeremy Stein says it might be a corporate herd mentality.
Everybody's kind of waiting for things to pick up. Nobody wants to get out in front and overextend themselves and do a lot of hiring. I mean, I think that's a good story. I don't know how convincing it is.
And there are disadvantages to waiting for things to pick up. Christopher Gergen is with the Hart Leadership Program at Duke University. He says firms should be more focused on hiring workers now.
If you are not getting back into the game and not trying to take on some of this great talent that is on the bench, you're going to be surpassed by your competitors.
When the recovery finally takes off, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Among the many other things he's known for, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has taken up the cause of public health. He's banned smoking in bars in the Big Apple. He's outlawed trans fats in restaurants. And today, he took aim at Coke and Pepsi and the rest of the sugary drink crowd. Bloomberg asked the Department of Agriculture to change the rules on food stamps so that New Yorkers can't use them to buy sugar-sweetened drinks. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
New York wants to study the effects of a temporary 2-year ban on sugary drinks for the nearly 2 million city residents on food stamps. Would poor people make better nutritional choices or just spend their own money on certain sodas, juices, and sports drinks? Michael Jacobson at the Center for Science in the Public Interest says USDA should allow the experiment, if for nothing else, to settle the argument.
Nutrition advocates saying it's crazy to allow people to buy sugar water with public dollars. And anti-hunger advocates in the soda industry saying, no, the food stamp program is an income supplement program, and people should be allowed to buy whatever they want.
Jacobson believes a ban would trim the above-average consumption of sweet drinks among poor people and reduce obesity.
There can be tremendous economic benefits through better nutrition. Cities can save money because taxpayers chip in for Medicaid.
But some advocates for the poor say soda would be just the beginning. How long before ice cream, chips, and candy are banned as well? Ellen Vollinger with the Food Research and Action Center says poor families might abandon food stamps altogether.
When people are treated differently in a grocery line, it can make them feel stigma and can make them less likely to want to participate in the program.
In the past, the Agriculture Department has favored carrots over sticks to improve nutrition for poor families. It's experimenting with offering bonus food stamps for people who spend more on fresh fruits and vegetables. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, people were pretty much sitting on their hands waiting for tomorrow's big jobs report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President's Press Secretary Robert Gibbs took up where Tim Geithner left off yesterday. Gibbs said at a press conference this morning the White House is watching what Beijing does with its currency, much as Secretary Treasury said yesterday. For American companies, though, currency is only part of the China puzzle that they have to solve. There's plenty of cheap labor. It's a growing consumer market. But access to it comes at a price, literally. Foreigners in China not only get charged more, but companies from other countries have to negotiate Chinese policies that can make doing business over there a bit risky. Our new Shanghai Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz is on the line to explain. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So we'll get to the official business part of this interview in a second, but you are a foreigner in China. Tell me your story.
Yeah, I am, and thank you for letting me vent a little. One of the first things we had to tackle in China was getting my son into a preschool. Now, my wife and I had originally plans to put our son in a local public preschool, and we had help from a Chinese friend. And he called up one school and was quoted a price of 1,000 renminbi, about $150 for the fall semester.
Which is
not
good,
a bad deal,
right? A whole semester, that's good, yeah.
Yeah, but when I called to seal the deal, they asked me where I was from. I told them, and then all of a sudden, the price shot up from 150 to more than $1,000.
Yeah, which is known in the vernacular, right, as the foreigner price?
Yeah, you know, it's a little here, a little there. You know, you get used to it after a while because it doesn't add up to a lot of money usually. But for big American companies, this type of special treatment can cost a lot of money.
Well, Rob, lay it out a little bit for me, would you? Because other than actually paying higher prices, which certainly private Americans do and some companies as well, there are ways that the Chinese put pressure on American and foreign companies.
Well, the government has a goal of China becoming the global tech leader by 2050. Now, in order to achieve this, they've passed what are called indigenous innovation policies. Now, all of this sounds like a great idea, but many foreign companies think these policies are less about China's innovation and more about China finding ways to steal foreign technology.
Well, how so? Give me an example.
One of these policies says if a company wants to sell high-tech products to any state-owned enterprise or government office in China, which is a huge market, the company has to register the trademark for the product in China. Now, that doesn't fly with a lot of foreign companies because it means they basically have to hand over their blueprints of their high-tech doodads to China. And it's not a good idea unless you want to see your product copied and sold to the world's biggest consumer market. So foreign companies complained, and earlier this year, China backed down and changed part of that policy. But one policy China didn't change is the CCC mark. Now, this is a sticker that you'll find on electric appliances in China. It proves that a certain product was inspected by a Chinese government standards agency and deemed to be safe. Now, if you're a company importing anything, you plug into a wall, you need one of these stickers on it. But in order to get it, one of the things you have to do is you've got to pay for Chinese government inspectors to visit your factory and see how you make the product.
Yeah, and let me guess, they're taking very careful notes and they're taking it back to, you know, whatever the Chinese company is.
Well, that's what a lot of foreign companies think, and they're worried it's another way to steal their technology. But foreign executives rarely criticize China's government. You know, the China market's just too important for them to rock the boat, so they usually hide behind trade associations and let them do the dirty work. But in the last 6 months, we've seen leaders from Microsoft, GE, Siemens, and BASF come through China and speak very publicly about their criticism of these policies. You know, this issue has been big enough for them to step out and say something.
What are the Chinese saying, though? I mean, they're not sitting down and taking this.
No, they're not. You know, the Chinese government has strongly defended these policies. Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao recently said he thought China's investment environment for foreign companies was as healthy as ever. It's a valid argument in some ways. All you have to do is look at foreign direct investment in China. It's gone up for 13 straight months. So while foreign companies may be starting to grumble about doing business in China, they're not packing their bags yet.
Our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, with the ever-increasing and ever more complicated Chinese market. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott.
Tomorrow's going to be a big day for the politics of the American economy. The September unemployment report lands in the morning. It's going to be the last look at the labor market before the November elections and the November Fed meeting on interest rates. By way of reminder, the unemployment rate right now is 9.6%. And just to keep it steady at that level, never mind, bring it down. The economy needs to add more than 100,000 jobs a month. Nobody's come up with a good way to find those jobs yet, but commentator and economist Susan Athey says we're missing a huge opportunity.
Did you know that every time you do a search on Google or Bing, you're improving the quality of the search engine? The more people click on a search advertisement from a clothing company or on a link to an online news story, the more prominently it is displayed for the next consumer. And the firms constantly experiment to get things right. They watch what consumers do and adapt their products in response to the results of their experiments. But designing the right experiment is difficult. To see just one example, consider spam. An email provider wants to eliminate spam from your inbox. It is a nuisance for all of us. That company might test out a new way to filter spam. The filter may do a great job in short-term experiments when the spammers don't have a chance to respond. But once the new filter is introduced in practice, spammers may find a way around the filter. So that means that some legitimate email is filtered out, and the end result may be that you haven't solved the spam problem at all. You could very well end up worse than where you started, even though the experimental numbers looked great. So, if you want to figure out whether a new product will work out the way you hope, you need to be able to anticipate how people will react to your innovation. That is, you don't just have to be a good statistician. It's not just about the numbers that come out of simple experiments. It is about predicting how people will react to the changes you make. You need to understand behavior and how to build models that reflect the choices we all make. Unfortunately, our universities and business schools haven't figured out how to train students to do this kind of modeling and prediction. That is, we aren't preparing students to manage the new data-driven businesses. And let's face it, this is where our economy is headed as consumers are spending more and more of their time online. Creating new jobs in this economy is a must, but making sure that the workforce is ready for the jobs where our growth is happening is more important. The good news is that the young people who do develop the talent and skills to capitalize on this opportunity will be in high demand, which puts them in a great position in today's tough economy.
Susan Athey is a professor of economics at Harvard University. You can send us your thoughts. Drop us a line at marketplace.org. That's our website. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up.
Typically, a 3% growth rate for any city across North America would be considered, wow, what a great place we've got. We're growing at 9.
Can you say Boomtown? I can. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 19 points today. That's about a 10%, ended at 10,948. The NASDAQ put on 3 points, a 10%, finished at 2383. The S&P 500 fell 1 point, also a 10%, 1158 at the bell. Alcoa slumped 1.3% today. The biggest U.S. aluminum maker reported lower third-quarter profits today, but it did say global markets were looking up. Still, a weaker dollar raises Alcoa's costs for its raw materials. Adobe Systems built up more than 11% today. The New York Times reported that Microsoft has come calling, and the CEOs of the two companies met to talk over Apple's dominance in mobile phones recently. Microsoft rose 0.4% today. Apple didn't really do a thing. The price of the 10-year T-notes rose again. The yield fell to 2.38%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. By the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering 4 sections of ideas and information, available at newsstands every Saturday. And by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information at MassMutual.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for September. The winner of the Nobel Peace Prize is announced in Oslo, Norway. And Academy Award-winning screenwriter and actor Matt Damon turns 40. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
We're back with Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Outside interest groups, that is, organizations that operate independently of political campaigns, are spending record amounts of money in this year's midterm elections, almost $100 million so far. That is, we grant you, a relative drop in the bucket when all told $3 billion might be spent on elections this year. But a lot of the money that's going to those outside groups is coming from businesses. The Supreme Court ruled earlier this year that's okay. Companies and unions are allowed to spend as much as they want on campaign ads right up till Election Day. And Nancy Marshall Genza reports now from Washington they are taking full advantage of that ruling.
The biggest spending outside interest groups are aligned with conservatives this year. One of the largest, American Crossroads, launched a $4 million ad campaign this week. It's targeting Senate races in 8 key states, including Nevada, where Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is running for re-election.
Harry Reid says no one can do more than he can. Really, Harry?
The American Crossroads ads talk about reining in President Obama. That message appeals to corporate donors concerned about the laws overhauling health care and financial services. But these donors find something else appealing about American Crossroads and its sister group, Crossroads GPS. American Crossroads has to reveal its donors, but not until after the election. Crossroads GPS never has to list them. Dave Leventhal is with the Center for Responsive Politics. He says companies are shoveling donations into outside groups like these because they like the anonymity, and for good reason.
because some of your customers may be liberals, some may be conservatives, and if you're on the wrong side of the message, then it's very possible that they're going to go elsewhere with their business.
Outside groups aren't new. Earlier this year, though, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations and unions can spend unlimited amounts on campaign ads, hence the avalanche of money into outside groups. Columbia Law School professor Richard Berfald says these groups also allow corporations to pool their money.
And then, in effect, having it put to work by political operatives that you think are supporting the interests of your corporation.
President Bush's political advisor, Karl Rove, helped found the Crossroads groups. But American Crossroads spokesman Jonathan Collegio says there are liberal interest groups, too.
Liberal and center-left organizations kind of designed this framework of outside groups that you see operating on the right.
Collegio says liberal groups would like to match conservatives' political spending. They just don't have the money. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Crude oil has been sticking right in the $70 to $80 barrel range for a while now, but whatever it costs, the fact is that, at least for now, the global economy needs oil. Lots of it. Not too long ago, we heard a couple of stories about the oil sands up in Canada. They're the world's second largest petroleum reserves outside Saudi Arabia. It's heavy oil, trapped in a mixture of clay and water and sand. What we didn't tell you about, though, is the place that supports that enterprise. Fort McMurray, Alberta, is the official name. Others just call it a boomtown. Sean Cole reports.
Fort McMurray is a rambling little hamlet way up in northeast Alberta on the Athabasca River. If it weren't for the oil sands, it would never be as bustling and as moneyed as it is. I landed on a Sunday and wandered over to the Peter Pond Shopping Center, where I met August Thibodeau. He's the stereotype of an oil sands laborer, a guy from eastern Canada who couldn't find work back home, lives in temporary housing north of town, flies back to New Brunswick when he can.
It's just I don't like the rush of this place, eh? And everybody's in a rush to rat race.
It's about the money.
It's about the money, exactly. You know what I mean? It's where you have money, you have problems, right?
Like drugs, he says. Crack. And alcoholism. Of course, where you have money, you also have money.
There's people that's got university degrees that don't make the money that a person can make here right in a year, right? They pay me $2,000 a week here. Clear my pocket.
This is the usual depiction of Fort Mac, a gold rush-style boomtown where transient workers parachute in for lavish wages and questionable entertainment. And you'd better make a lot of money if you want to buy property here. A mobile home can run you nearly $500,000. Almost every job is somehow connected to the oil sands, directly or indirectly. About 80,000 people live here permanently, on top of all the temporary folks, which means, of course, a really long wait at the drive-through coffee chain.
Is the line for Tim Hortons always this long?
Oh, yeah. It's short today.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's short today, man. Yeah.
Toby Krakowski is another laborer at the mines. He's lived here for all of his 36 years.
What was it like 36 years ago?
A lot better than it is now.
How so?
Calmer. More of a family town now. It's, you know what I mean? It's a boom town, so it's overcrowded. The infrastructure's behind, right? So it's...
They're not keeping up with the pace of the growth.
They're not keeping up with the pace of the growth. No, not at all.
Thank you. Is this a boom town?
It's not a boom town in terms of the stereotypical 1870s boom town of the Wild West. That we are not.
Philip Cooper is director of communications for the regional municipality of Wood Buffalo, in which Fort McMurray sits. He doesn't dispute that they're not keeping up with the growth. In fact, when the recession hit...
One of our key messages for quite a while there is that we welcome the slowdown.
That is the first time I've ever heard the sentence, we welcome the slowdown.
Yeah, well, welcome to Fort McMurray. I think typically, a 3% growth rate for any city across North America would be considered, wow, what a great place we've got. We're growing at 9. So that's outrageous. You cannot function, you cannot plan, you cannot administer city services with that kind of growth.
But this isn't the story he wants me to tell. People are coming here and putting down roots, he says. It's already a stable community, and the more the town stabilizes, the better chance it has of sticking around after there's no fuel in the ground anymore.
That has been the experience of American cities. For the most part, North American cities are built around initial natural resources, and then over time, with changes in technology, changes in lifestyle, changes in society, they evolve into something different.
But I think that imagining a diversification of that economy and of that
locale that would not be tied into oil is really difficult.
Sarah Doro teaches sociology at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. She's part of a team researching community issues in Fort McMurray. And she says most of the locals they talk to imagine the city will either be gutted in 70 or 80 years, or it'll be a primo destination for environmental researchers developing new cleanup technologies.
I find it fascinating that either it's a dust bowl or we have to be some kind of environmental center of excellence, because I think most people know that most diversification in the area is, at this point anyway, going to be tied to oil sands development.
Of course, all of this is way down the road. In the here and now, town officials are touting more concrete projects, like this new huge recreation facility at McDonald Island Park. The mayor insisted that I go there. It's nice. Big old hockey rink, tennis courts, a guy hanging out by the tennis courts playing guitar. He wouldn't give me his name, but he's a bus driver for the oil companies. And he's from the east, and lives in temporary housing.
Fort Murray's a very nice town, you know. That's didn't what I heard, you know.
Oh, you heard bad things about the town.
You know, you hear about the pollution, and you know what I mean? It's not a nice place. When I came here, I was very surprised about the town. It's a nice little town.
He said he liked the rush of the place, how busy it is. And then he played me a song.
Imagine you, I do. I think about you day and night. It's only right to think about the girl you love. And all the tight, happy together.
I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
If I should call you up and this the dime, and you say you belong to me.
You can see what a modern-day boomtown looks like and the oil sands that are driving it, too. They're in a slideshow on our website, marketplace.org.
I can't see me loving nobody but you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. On the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, as it happens, a true story. I was on my way home last night listening to my public radio station when the local All Things Considered host gave the score of the Phillies-Reds playoff game. No spoiler alert, no nothing. Although I suppose it did save me 3 hours of watching the game on TiVo. I don't know. But today, a possible solution, a new service that lets fans know when a game is worth watching. Thooze tracks games in real time, how close the score is, what the pacing's like, good individual plays. Then it alerts you by email or text when a game is getting really hot. Best thing of all, it's not going to tell you the final score, like some people I listen to. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 19 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ put on 3 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 lost a point. Wait for it, a tenth of 1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, a history lesson. Why the French go on strike so much.
The villagers love to lie around in the sun, spend time delousing one another. Part and parcel of village life was not working.
It's the lice, who knew? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.